Affiliated, the Honorable Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable Supreme Court of Texas are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Be seated. This morning, the court has two arguments on its oral submission docket. They are H.E. Butt Grocery Company versus Vinnie Bellotto and Mobile Oil Corporation versus Anna Mae Allender and others. In each call, the court is allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument. The petitioner may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by advising the marshal of our court. We'll take a brief recess in between the two arguments. These arguments are being recorded by our clerk, and you may purchase a tape of the arguments by making application with the clerk. In the first call, the court has asked for, Justice Hankinson is recused, and the court has asked the governor for an assignment of a justice in this case pursuant to statute, and Chief Justice Linda Thomas of the Fifth Court of Appeals sits with the court in this call. Justice Hankinson will return for the second call. Court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in Butt versus Bellotto.
May I please the court, Mr. Wallace Richardson will present argument for petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for a vote.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, do we ask juries in this state to, in a broad sense, do justice or just to declare a victor or a person who's defeated, or do we simply ask them to answer fact questions without regard to the legal consequence of their answers? That's the question before the court.
Do you really believe that the jury does not know the effect of their answers when the lawyers can argue and spend all week with them, perhaps, and try to channel them in a certain direction?
Yes, sir. I do believe that. I believe that the jury, the attorneys, will certainly do their best to advocate and let the jury know what's important to them. But they don't know comparative responsibility. It's not as if they're given the Civil Practice and Remedies Code and know the precise point at which contributory negligence finding is going to bar recovery by the plaintiff. And it's not authorized, the counsel is not authorized to tell them the effect of their actions and their arguments. They can emphasize what they wish to emphasize. And I think in most cases, a good advocate is going to get his point across. But they are not allowed to know the effect of their answer.
Isn't the same effect of the answer known if we have a predicate question concerning either gross negligence or punitive damages? We have predicate questions for that, and I presume
yes.
That you believe that there's nothing improper about that.
I think there's nothing improper. I think the jury would know if there's no negligence, but there's not going to be gross negligence. I think a common jury with ordinary intelligence is going to understand that right off the bat. I don't think that's a problem, and I don't think Rule 277 is meant to address that sort of situation. Rule 277 says the court shall not advise the jury of the effect of their answer. That is a mandatory rule. It shall not happen. And the only time that the jury, that the court might give the jury the legal effect of their answers is when it's incidentally part of a proper instruction. That's well, not the case here.
Let's talk about that, because in Rule 277, there are 5 different paragraphs. And the key phrase in Rule 277, as far as this case is concerned, is the sentence, the court may predicate the damage question or questions upon affirmative findings of liability. And that sentence is in the paragraph where it talks about the apportionment of liability among the parties.
Yes.
Why is that not significant?
Well, that wasn't done in this case. There were 3 questions presented to the jury, right? The first one was the liability question. The second one was an affirmative defense, HEB's affirmative defense. And the third was damages. If you're going to predicate on an affirmative finding of liability, it had to go to question number 1. Now, counsel's argument on the other side here is, well, you can read this rule when it says affirmative findings of liability to encompass the jury's denial of an affirmative defense. And I raised the example last time of the statute of limitations. And there are many other examples. Look at Rule 94, and you get all the affirmative defenses that a defendant might have available to him. Well, that is not an affirmative finding of liability, but counsel would like you to read that as an affirmative finding of liability. It's just not so. That you can't read the rule that way. And it has to be only an incidental comment. In other words, in the ordinary case, where let's say their comparative responsibility is not submitted at all, The first question is, did the negligence of HEB proximately cause the occurrence in question? And then the second question would be damages. Well, the incidental advising the jury the effect of their answers is to say, if you find that HEB was not negligent in this case, well, then you don't have to answer damages. That's okay. That's what the rule is talking about. And that rule is premised on, I believe, Greiger versus Vega and Canon Motor Company, the cases that are cited in my brief. Now, that is incidental because the jury, any jury of common understanding and intelligence is going to know that if you don't have liability, you're not going to receive damages.
Looking at Rule 277, that last sentence, would you agree that the court could properly instruct the jury by saying, if you find HEB negligent, then answer the damage question? Otherwise, do not answer the damage question.
Yes.
If the court can do that, why can't the court say, if you find HEB to be 50% negligent or more, then answer the damage question? The first question I read to you is more instructive to the jury than the second question about finding 50% negligent or more.
How does your second question enable the jury to render a verdict? That's the test. Rule 277, you're quoting from 277, the very second sentence says, the court shall submit such instructions and definitions as shall be proper to enable the jury to render a verdict. Now, the second question that you're talking about, that's a question that instructs the jury on an esoteric concept they have no idea about, and they have no role to play in answering that question. They don't even need to know that there's a 51% bar in order to answer the question whether or not 50% or more is assignable to the plaintiff.
But isn't the second question I asked you less instructive to the jury about what the eventual outcome of the case will be?
No, the jury is not going to know from answering the second question unless you tell them what the effect is going to be. On the other hand, the jury is going to know, most juries are going to know, that if there's no negligence, there's no liability. I think that's a good, and that concept is not my concept. This court has declared that. Starting in 1913, in the 1930s, 1954, this court has said that over and over again. But that sort of thing is not objectionable.
In some instances, this would not be harmful error, depending on the type of jury you had. If it was a more knowledgeable jury,
No, I think it's harmful error, period.
Always.
Yes, I do. Otherwise, the rule has no effect. The rule doesn't mean what it says, and parties are free to ignore it, and the court's free to ignore it. And I don't think that this court wants to render an opinion that says, yes, here are the rules of the procedure, but these are discretionary with the court and with counsel. If you don't want to follow them, you don't have to. If you do, you do. But in this case, we don't have to worry about that because harmful error is demonstrated. Number one, the jury came out with a question asking precisely, what do you mean by this if or conditioning instruction?
It probably was an attempt to say they didn't understand what the instruction was.
But just their you know, focus on it. The question is, you're asking us, judge, to determine the legal effect of our answer. We don't understand. So give us more instruction on it. We're trying to get to the point that you're telling us to know what the legal effect of our answers is. And we don't understand it, so give us more clarification. So it's clear that they're focused on that very conditioning instruction that's at issue here. It was, the jury came back 50-50, and as counsel admitted in the last argument, it was a very closely and highly contested case. So I don't think harmful error is an issue, and they haven't reasonably raised that as an issue in this case. So if the court agrees with our position that this was an improper instruction, that I think the only thing the court can do is reverse and remand. Now,
Mr. Jefferson,
yes.
Tell me, please, your view of what this court intended when it changed Rule 277 and added the sentence about predicating that it was okay or discretionary to predicate damages on liability.
Your Honor, I think what the court intended, I think the court looked at its own opinions in the years before this new rule came out and said, how is it that we have been submitting cases to the jury? And the court came upon Greiger and came upon Cannon. the cases that are cited in brief. And Greiger and Cannon say just what this rule says, nothing different from what this rule says. What they say is it's not error to condition damages on an affirmative finding of liability in a contributory negligence case, the very same issue that's presented here. But they said, but it is, and we're going to maintain that in Texas you shall not advise a jury of the legal effect of its answers if the jury doesn't know that anyway. So in other words, you're not entitled to give them a handout on the Civil Practice and Remedies Code and say, see section 33.001. And you're not entitled to give them a handout and say, see section 16, talking about statutes of limitations. And I think the reason, Your Honor, is pretty clear. And I don't think that it's really our responsibility to get into the reason, because I think the rule is clear. But I think the policy behind that rule is this, that there are going to be cases where the plaintiff is sympathetic, where the jury would want to. I started out saying, do we ask jury to do justice? Do we ask them to declare a victory? Well, where the juries would want to find for the plaintiff. But if you only ask them the fact question in the premise liability case, who is more responsible? They're going to say, they might say, well, she is more responsible than the premise owner is in this case. Maybe a little bit, but definitely so. At least 51%, we give it to her. But if the jury is told, well, that's going to make the difference between her going home with a recovery and her going home empty-handed, and it's a sympathetic plaintiff, well, then the jury is going to nudge their finding one percentage point, which is not that hard to do. And it's not just a plaintiff issue. I mean, there could be cases where the plaintiff is, to the jury's mind, someone not worthy of receiving a monetary recovery. And so the jury could do the same thing. Well, yes, maybe HEB is 51% at fault here, but look at this plaintiff. You know, look at the evidence that came in about her, you know, contradicting herself, you know, at trial and during depositions, and she was lying, obviously, about this and that, and she didn't treat her family well and all that. So let's not give her any money for this. And we can do it just based on 1% point. And the same thing with statute of limitations. You know, a jury's going to say, and this is the legal technicality that's presented to a jury, if they're instructed on statute of limitations, they're going to be told, you know, depending on what you find, what date you find, the plaintiff is not going to recover. And they're going to say, well, that's silliness, you know? I mean, that's only one day. But the law in Texas is that one day makes a big amount of difference. So I think what they were getting at, what the court was getting at, and what the committee was getting at, when they looked at Rule 277, was a policy that in Texas, the jury's role is limited. It is only to find facts. It is not to concern themselves with the effect of their answer. And the reason I think that that's so, and I can say it with utter confidence, is that's what the instructions have. That's what the admonitions to the jury are. In the very boilerplate, very first couple pages, don't concern yourself with the effect of your answer. That's what Rule 277 says. And I don't think there's any way around that here. Now,
why do you think in Rule 277 it used the word affirmative findings of liability? In other words, liability does not attach unless HEB is at least 50% responsible.
But the jury does not have that role to determine that. That's why they use the term finding. The jury is a fact finder. Now, the question of, and we know, I mean, we can know from all of us from looking at a jury charge, what's the liability question, just as we can here. I mean, and no one's ever told me in this case that question number two submits a liability question. It's only question number one. Everyone knows that. I mean, the lawyers and the judge know that.
In this case, liability does not attach unless HEB is at least 50% negligent, correct?
Well, yes, liability, if the plaintiff is 51% or more, then there would be no liability. That's correct.
So why, because 277 says the court may predicate the damage question upon an affirmative finding of liability, why can the court then not do the instruction based upon the affirmative finding of liability, which in this case is 50% negligent or more?
That's not the affirmative finding of liability. It's an affirmative, you go back to Moulton.
Let me ask you this. If the jury answered that HEB was 35% negligent and Belotto was 65% negligent, you would not argue that that's an affirmative finding of liability?
No.
Right.
And so the only way you can do the predicate question is if HEB is affirmatively found liable, which means it is 50% more negligent.
Well, I mean, that just begs the question. I mean, do you tell the jury? The jury doesn't need to know what the effect of their answer is. And so
I'm not concerned about what the jury needs or doesn't need to know. Well, all I'm working with is the sentence structure of the last sentence of the third paragraph of Rule 277.
Well, you can't
and
read...
And what that entitles to the parties to inform the jury.
You cannot read the provision that you're talking about without reading the rest of the rule, which says, number one, you shall not tell them the effect of their answers, and number two, the only exception to that is when it incidentally apprises them in a proper way of the effect of their answers. And then you go back to what is proper. Well, proper, in Texas anyway, and it has been for years, is to instruct the jury on something that will enable them to reach a verdict. And the question number two, the conditioning instruction after that, doesn't do that in any sense. Not whatsoever. Now, the criticism, and I want to get to this because one of the things that was a concern last time was, well, isn't it more efficient, you know, to tell the jury, I'm going to use a minute of my rebuttal time if that's appropriate, that is it more efficient to tell the jury the effect of their answers, because then the jury can go home early. And my point and my disagreement with that is fundamental, that efficiency doesn't override the rule of law. It never has in this court. And if the rule says you cannot do it, you cannot do it, whether or not it's more efficient to do it. And I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time.
Let me ask you a question, I think the answer of which will not come out of your rebuttal time. One part of Rule 277 upon which you hang your hat is the language in the last paragraph that says that the court shall not advise the jury of the effect of its answers. Okay? You agree with that? That's one key aspect of your position.
Yes. The court shall not advise the jury of the effect of their answers. Certainly.
And you do agree that it is okay for the court to tell the jury that if you don't find any negligence on the part of HEB, you don't have to answer the damage question.
The rule says the court may predicate the damage question or questions upon affirmative findings of liability.
All right.
Yes, sir. I agree with that.
Any other questions? Thank you, Ken. The court is ready for argument from the respondent.
May it please the court and counsel, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Les Mendelson from the Bexar County Bar. I'm assisted by Mr. Ricky Poole. My voice is several octaves lower than it normally is, and I think the Lord has afflicted me and told me to slow down a little bit. I hope I can continue and finish this. I would ask the court to please focus on two very important points that seem to have been raised. The issue in this case is whether or not the trial court abused her discretion. The second issue is, what was the purpose of the rule change in 1987 effective in 1988? We will show you two things. The trial court did not abuse her discretion because she did follow this court's teaching in EB in 1990, which was that so long as the court acts with reference to guiding legal principles and rules, there is no abuse of discretion.
Do you believe that there's more latitude given to a trial judge in formulating the charge than there is in making other pretrial and trial and post-trial legal rules?
I think that, as I understand what this court has held, that this case would be that the charge, assuming that abuse of discretion is the standard, would be similar to the rulings of this court on admission of evidence. To the same extent that this court has held that a trial judge is the gatekeeper in determining whether or not to admit certain evidence under the Robinson standard that's been established, I think that the same standard applies here. However, we're talking about a rule promulgated by this court legislatively through its legislative process that says that the trial court may predicate the damage issue on affirmative findings of liability.
But a judge, a trial judge who finds that evidence, expert testimony is unreliable, has no discretion to let it in. Nor does a judge who finds that it is reliable have any discretion to let, to keep it out.
To the same extent, Your Honor, the trial judge has no discretion other than to do one or the other.
All right, so in this case, you're arguing that the instruction must be given. And why would a judge...
The instruction must not be given. It is discretionary.
Why would a judge decide it one way or the other?
Well, it may be that it's a... I'm not certain what this court was thinking when it adopted the rule, other than by relying upon the notes and the testimony from the advisory committee.
But I suppose you'll come to that. But why would a judge decide to give the instruction or not to give the instruction in a particular case?
It may be because of the particular nature of the case.
What about the nature of the case motivated to give it or not?
I think that as with legislation, there was a compromise in establishing this rule, and it was the decision that was made that it's up to the trial court, if it's properly done, that there would be no error.
I just need your best answer.
My best answer is...
To the question, why would a judge decide one way or the other?
I believe it would be based upon the particular facts of the case. In our case...
What facts would make a difference is what I'm trying to get at.
If it is there was a decision that was made by this court in 1987 when it adopted the rule that, as opposed to taking the blindfold completely off the jury, which is what the argument was then, in that legislative process, in that committee process, do we take the blindfold off the jury completely? There was a vote where 8 people wanted to make it mandatory. That would have taken the blindfold off completely, they thought. And to go further, the majority said, no, we will leave it to the trial court's discretion. In some cases, you would have the conditioning and some not. Harry Reasoner, in, and I think you'll find it around page 249 under tab A, said that there may be some circumstances when you may want to, it may be a case where you should go ahead and let them answer the damage question because it may be a tough question of law and you would want to reverse and render the case as opposed to reverse and remand the case.
The word may is in the rule.
That is correct. The word, the problem with the question, Your Honor, and I'm being as respectful as I can, is that it begs the question because this court made the legislative decision to allow the trial judge to have that discretion. If it's a bad idea, then legislatively change the rule, but don't punish the trial judge for doing what the rule said she could do.
We're not punishing the trial judge at all.
Whether we
made that rule or not, we're going to decide. All I'm trying to get at is, if I were a trial judge and I were trying to decide whether to give this instruction or not, what would I think about? What would you want me to think about? What would you argue? I'd say, I'm not sure whether to give this or not. So then what's your argument?
The argument is that if the jury believes you tell the jury that because of broad form submission, if you believe that the negligence of the defendant is more than 50%, then you may answer the damage question. If you find otherwise, don't. Now, that does not necessarily presuppose that it tells the jury the effect of its answer. I recently tried a case where the jury answered a percentage for the defendant and a percentage for the plaintiff, 65-35. In questioning one of the jurors, she said, one of the questions I have is, does the plaintiff get all the money or just 65%? They didn't know. Now, the point is that this court made the determination to allow the trial judge to do it. If it's a bad idea, then change the rule, but not in this case. Don't change what the rule says, because it gives the court the discretion to do so.
Mr. Mendelson, Mr. Jefferson's argument, if I understand it, is that what limits the application of the may in the rule is the notion that the predicate has to be on affirmative findings of liability.
Absolutely.
And this comparative issue, it's not an affirmative finding of liability. You're obviously arguing, yes, it is, and otherwise it works.
Otherwise it makes no sense.
But then the example he used is statute of limitations. The factual determination of statute of limitations would be what date did the plaintiff know of or should have known of this cause of action, and that would be the date.
Correct.
And that would not inform them of the answer to their verdict. But if you conditioned the damages, you can get the jury to answer that question without informing them the result of their answer. But if you condition damages, you end up with a question like this. If you find that the knowledge was learned on or after this date, then answer the damages issue. Otherwise, do not answer the damages issue. And then you've taken a question which does not inform them the result of their answer, which you could get an answer, and turn it into a question which does.
So it removes
it from, well, why wouldn't that apply to any sort of bar to a recovery?
Because that's not what the rule said. That's not what you did legislatively when you made the rule. This court is merely, should not be reinventing the rule in this proceeding.
That's not my question. You may be focused on it. Ms. Jefferson is arguing that it's the affirmative finding of liability. You're arguing that this comparative constitutes an affirmative finding. Right. He said, no, it doesn't. And
sure.
He said, if we accept that this rule is an affirmative finding, then it permits other questions that are bars to recovery to be fashioned in such a way as to meet your affirmative finding notion and thus...
Based on what Justice Abbott asked, I feel that it was not the intention of this court to mean predicating damage question on affirmative findings, plural, of liability, not negligence, not finding, it's findings of liability, that it was the intention of this and the purpose for this rule, the intention of this court and the purpose for this rule, to allow that removing of the blindfold. Now, it does, to some extent, inform. The point is, in this case, you could not condition, it makes no sense to say, if you answered that HEB was negligent and this negligence was the proximate cause, then answer the damage question. That would not accomplish the purpose for what the rule was established for when you read the committee reports. Because the fight there was, do you take off the blindfold completely and let the jurors know the effect of their answer, or do you do it just a little bit? They decided to do it just a little bit. This court adopted that, and the little bit was to allow conditioning of the damage question on affirmative findings of liability.
Okay,
Theoretically, I can answer your question. Theoretically, you could say, if you answer question number 1, 3, 6, and 11, yes, then answer the damage question, whatever the number may be. I think as the rule is written, you could do that. Whether it's good policy or not was a decision that was made years ago, and if you want to change that rule, if you don't like the policy, then change the policy going through the committee process.
Well, let me focus on my question a little bit more.
Okay.
Is it, you could ask the jury, give me the date that the plaintiff knew or should have known about the injury. You could also ask the jury, if you find that he knew or should have known on this date or later, then answer the damages issue, otherwise do not. Is it your view that that second question, that doesn't have to be asked in that form, but could be, is that second question permissible?
It probably is permissible, but to answer Mr. Chester's heck, that may be the kind of case when you don't condition, because it becomes too confusing. It may be better not to do it in that case. You're giving the trial court discretion. That's the point that we're making throughout here. The Grasso case was a case where the instruction was that if you find that the defendant was negligent and you find that the plaintiff was not negligent, then answer the damage question. This court said under the rule as it existed then, when and Fox against Dallas Hotel was also the rule on special issues, you couldn't do that. If you look at the committee notes, Grasso and Grieger were never even mentioned. If counsel is correct that the committee and this court adopting the committee's recommendation was merely codifying Grasso and Grieger, why would not those cases have even been mentioned? The reason is because that's not what this court did. This court made a change. It made a conscious change to take the blindfold off a little bit to allow some condition. And again, I say, if it's bad policy, then change the policy legislatively. But do not tell this trial judge, who followed a custom and practice that had been established for 5 years, the plain language in the rule, two court of appeals cases, that she did not follow guiding principles of law in making her decision to condition. That just, it just isn't the case. If HEB, as a defendant, in the trial of this case, had established that it had followed the custom and practice in the industry in the manner in which it took care of its floors and was protecting its invitees from harm, this court would not hesitate for a moment in finding that it had met its proper standard of care. How then could this court say that if a trial judge follows the custom and practice that has applied for 5 years between 1988 and 1993 when this case was tried, and followed two court of appeals opinions, and the plain language in this rule was not following guiding principles or rules of law?
Mr. Madison?
Yes.
How much weight or reliance do you place on the fact that the question submitted was in the pattern jury chart?
We don't rely upon that. It's very clear that this case is not about the pattern jury charge instruction. It does not. It is not our argument that it is has the weight of law. It was mentioned by the Court of Appeals, but we think it's a straw man that's been established by the defendant and petitioner to be knocked down. This case is not about whether it's an abuse of discretion to follow the PJC. It certainly could be an abuse of discretion. It could be an error. But the point is what the court did was instruct as the rule says it may instruct.
Mr. Mendelson?
Yes, sir.
If the reason why the trial court submitted it is only because of the pattern jury charge, does that answer Judge Peck's question?
If it's only because of the pattern jury charge? If it's only because of the pattern jury charge and the pattern jury charge is not based upon legal principle, then it could be error. But it is based on legal principle because one legal principle is the plain language of the rule that you wrote. And the second thing is that she followed two Court of Appeals opinions.
But
and custom and practice.
But when you were talking about the pattern jury charge, you seemed to indicate that you did agree that by following that didn't mean that there could not be an abuse of discretion because of other cases that say this court has a prerogative to decide whether those are good, bad, or indifferent.
Well, if the language in the pattern jury charge is not based upon the law, then of course you can change what the pattern jury charge says and you can reject that. But the point is that when this rule was amended, the amendment specifically allowed the trial court to predicate on affirmative findings of liability. Now, you can create some difficult situations by doing that because you may have three or four questions that are necessary to have affirmative findings of liability. And it may inform the jurors that there can be damages awarded if you answer these certain questions. But that appears to me from the committee minutes and from the transcript that was what was intended. And if it wasn't what was intended, you have to look back to that to see if that's what the intent was. It would be inappropriate for you to say, well, we just disagree with that policy, to the same extent that if Mr. Justice Heck said, well, I don't think that if I were the trial judge in this case, I may not have admitted that testimony, but because the trial court does have the discretion to make a determination as to whether or not the witness who testified was qualified and if his testimony is reliable. As I understand the cases that have come down since Robinson, such as Roeder against Heiss and Longoria and Bloods, the Blood Bank case and others, that the court is saying that the trial judge has the discretion. It must apply certain standards, but you're giving the trial judge the opportunity there to make that determination. You're not going to second guess it.
Well, let's go back to the question just a second. If the premise is that the trial judge may submit this type of instruction based upon what the trial judge sees the facts are in the case, in other words, that's how you determine, you're not looking at the pattern jury charge, you're looking at the factual nature of the particular case, and the trial judge makes the decision to submit it. So would you agree that if it's based on a factual background, then this court, even under an abuse of discretion, is stuck because they made a factual determination to submit an instruction, or that we're not stuck?
I think it's a question of being stuck. I think the question is
whether
or not
we
trial
have to
court
give deference to the trial court's factual findings.
I think that you should. I think that the purpose was to give the trial judge that discretion.
Well, then my next question is the submission of an instruction based upon factual findings when you have a jury trial by the trial judge.
Is the instruction one that's based upon factual findings?
Yes.
Well,
by the trial judge when you have a jury trial.
Well, if in this instance, the second question was to apportion the fault, and that is a factual determination made by the jurors, and then the trial judge said, if it's more than so much or less than so much, answer this next question. Number one, it does not inform the jurors of the effect of their answers because they don't know how much money the defendant is going to have to pay, if anything, or how much money the plaintiff is going to receive.
But they do know, don't you think, that if that instruction's there, that if they say 51%, regardless of what money they find...
No question about it.
Well, because they're not going to reach that question.
No question about it, but that's what...
So doesn't that nudge them?
No.
Impermissibly?
No, it does not nudge them impermissibly at all because of the fact that that is what you said they could do. If it's not that, what is the purpose of that language there? The only purpose, if you look at what they argued about in the committee, was whether or not to allow it, to make it mandatory, or whether to allow the trial judge the discretion. And they decided that there are some cases, and I'm not sure what those cases are, but there may be some cases where the trial judge could or couldn't, would or wouldn't. It would not be a reversible error so long as the language did not inform the jurors of the effect of their answer or make an impermissible comment such as, if you find that the defendant is more than 50%, is less than 50% at fault, it will not, or if you find that the plaintiff is more than 50% at fault, then you will not be able to award any damages to this poor plaintiff that the defendant has hurt. That would be impermissible. But that is not what happened.
Thank you, counsel. You have 4.5 minutes.
Counsel, what's the difference between the issue here and the instruction, the conditional submission of exemplary damages? I believe question 4 asked if there was gross negligence, and if the jurors answer yes, answer the damage issue. If no, do not answer it. That seems to me similar to what was done.
I think a jury would understand that if there is no gross negligence, then there's not going to be a recovery of punitive damages. I think we can assume that.
Well, doesn't it nudge them?
No, I don't believe so. I think if the jury knows that already, then an instruction that says don't answer punitives unless you find gross negligence is just like an instruction that says don't answer damages, actual damages, unless you find negligence. I don't think there's anything objectionable about it, and the rule provides that you can do that, and I have no quarrel with that. What the quarrel I have in this case is, and counsel likes not to talk about this portion of the rule, is a portion that says the court shall not advise the jury the effect of their answers. Shall not do it.
You're getting into the heads of what you presume to be the universal knowledge of jurors as to what they know and what they don't know about the law.
I'm going by what this court has said is ordinary knowledge, and I don't have to go beyond that in this case.
Mr. Jefferson, you'd like to cite the...
Where have we said that...
Greiger versus Vega. Grasso, which was a commission adopted by the commission.
Well before the law was changed.
But the law...
Comparative negligence.
The law in Greiger and Grasso is exactly like the rule in 277. There's no difference between them.
If there were public service ads run by the State Bar of Texas every 30 seconds for a year saying in 1973, I think it was, the legislature adopted comparative negligence so that everybody knew. We got a poll and 70% of the people had watched those ads and understood the comparative negligence law. Then this would be just like predicating...
You know what? If I were the plaintiff's lawyer and I thought that this would benefit my client, then I would be doing that because I'd want them to know. But as it stands today, that's not the case.
How do we know?
Well, the court has said that, and I can't go any further.
We said that prior to this law being passed, back when there was a commission.
Mr. Chief Justice, I think that's the most I can say about that is that's common sense. That the jury does not know, an ordinary jury does not know the law in the detail that the court does. And that the lawyers did. I think, and I can't go further than that because I've not conducted the poll.
Justice Stone
asked a question last time, which I think is at the heart of this case, and that is, what's left of the rule if counsel is right over here? What's left of it? Because what he's saying is, you no longer have to look at the rule and say affirmative findings of liability. That's not the case. You can start looking at defenses, and then when you start looking at defenses...
No, wait a second. That's not true at all. Because the rule is clear in that one sense. The court may predicate the damage question on affirmative findings of liability. That's all he's arguing, and you're now trying to extend that beyond what he's arguing.
I'm not trying to do that. What I'm saying with the statute of limitations example, if you answer the statute of limitations one way, you don't have to reach damages. And he says that's okay. And what I'm saying is if that's okay, everything's okay. And if everything's okay, then you start getting into the point where why not? Why shouldn't you be able to tell the jury about the collateral source rule? Why shouldn't you be able to tell the jury?
Because that's not an affirmative finding of liability.
Well, but you're telling the jury that our death was not an affirmative finding of liability.
Isn't in the general rule in Texas that you don't inform the jury of the effect of their answers?
That's correct.
But we temper that rule with an acceptance that jury has common sense.
That's right.
And just by reading the liability question and answering it no, the jury with common sense is going to know there's not going to be liability for damages. But the jury cannot be expected to know that because some statutory policy of the legislature that there may be a bar to recovery, not to liability, but simply to recovery, depending on the particular facts of the case. That is, that the defendant is less than 50% liable, the legislature says, then the defendant won't have to pay. But that is not a common sense reading. That's simply a policy decision the legislature has made. And there's no basis for the jury to understand or even know that, and so coming back to the general rule that you don't inform the jury of the effect of their answers, a comparative decision or statute of limitations question is just not the type of question where through common sense you know that depending on how you answered it, it affected the outcome of the case. Isn't that right?
Yes, sir, and for that reason we request the court reverse the
decision. Any other questions? The court will now take a brief recess.